Greetings and salutations. Welcome to this March 2009 edition of Science News Update. I'm your host, Jim Campanella. This month, I am again going to be all over the map with my various news stories. There are always so many interesting things going on out there in the world of research that I sometimes feel like I'm so limited in what I can present to you guys in the very limited time that I have each month. The amount of material published in scholarly journals is actually becoming a problem that seems to be getting worse for scientists in general, although I suppose how you define worse would change your way of looking at the issue. I suppose it's a good thing that there are so many scientific articles that are being published, because it means that science is trundling along at an excellent clip at this point in history. At the same time, any one person who tries to keep up with the present science literature faces a greater and greater challenge than in the past. Even 15 years ago, when I did my doctoral degree research, I remember my graduate advisor making a regular weekly trip to the library, where he spent an afternoon going through several journals important to our field and making detailed notes of relevance on his sojourn. I am not sure this is quite so feasible anymore when the several relevant journals have doubled or even tripled in number. An ecologist, for example, would need to read a good 24 journals to ensure that he or she is keeping up with the literature. And some do that, but it's a bear of a job. It becomes an even more daunting task if you wander outside your specialty and try to read other types of literature. What am I getting at? Well, simply this. We cover a minuscule bite of the pizza pie out there, so forgive me if you ever feel slighted that I discuss so little every month. Anyway, first up is a weird little article that I came across in the American Journal of Physiology in a recent issue. Dr. Margie Reams' research group at Duke University found something odd when studying fetal development in rats. Reem and her colleagues exposed pregnant mice to either normal oxygen levels or low oxygen levels, and then identified embryos within that litter that had genetic mutations preventing norepinephrine synthesis. Norepinephrine is an adrenal hormone and neural transmitter that's part of the stress response in mammals. Among other things, it seems to work with adrenaline to trigger the fight-or-flight response. Reem's team, after identifying mice that did not make norepinephrine, monitored the fetus's physiological response to the oxygen conditions. It turned out that compared with their normal siblings, the norepinephrine-deficient fetuses did not tolerate hypoxia very well. And if they survived, they suffered from low heart rate, blood flow problems, excessive bleeding, and even heart failure. Again, not all that surprising. It would make sense for the stress response mutation along with low oxygen to be fatal. But the wild-type mice survived the hypoxic conditions just fine with no ill effects. After some study, Reem's group found that normal mice underwent hypoxic episodes all the time during development. They initially could not figure out why. Didn't it make more sense just to ensure that baby mice got enough oxygen all the time? This is the strange finding now. Evidently, exposure to hypoxia is crucial for some developmental processes. Hypoxia is the only way to activate a special protein called HIF. When HIF is activated, it attaches to DNA and allows 155 important developmental genes to be decoded. If it's not activated in a developing fetus, those genes are not turned on, and the animal suffers eye damage, abnormal heart and liver development, and even shortened arms and legs. Therefore, it seems to be important for an animal to experience brief episodes of hypoxia just to ensure that this gene product is activated so that it can activate important genes and ensure proper development. Of course, excessive hypoxia is definitely problematic, and if not immediately fatal, and it can result in growth restrictions, preterm delivery, and even sudden infant death syndrome, as well as heart problems that persist into mouse adulthood. Reem and company concluded that an animal protects itself from the damaging effects of hypoxia by releasing norepinephrine, which helps to maintain heart rate, blood flow, and oxygen levels throughout the body. Meanwhile, developing fetuses that experience hypoxia are able to activate essential developmental pathways and develop properly because HIF is activated. If the fetus can't synthesize the norepinephrine, then the effects of hypoxia are magnified and death almost as certain for the poor mouse. It seems likely that these results can be extended to human development, but Rehm and company are just beginning to determine whether that's the case in other mammals besides mice. Just to show you that stress in children is not always a bad thing, here's another article from the Proceedings of the Royal Society. Yes, Tony, that's one of yours in England. For a long time, ornithologists have suggested that maternal stress has an effect on embryos and eggs that are laid. Eunice Chin and her colleagues from Trent and Simon Fraser Universities have now shown that that seems to be very likely the case. By the way, human physiologists have been saying the same thing for years with human babies, and whenever they mention stress in babies in humans, it always seems to be with negative connotations. What's amazing is Chin's results with birds are really far from negative. To study the impact that maternal effects can have on offspring fitness, the researchers studied flight performance in European starlings. They used nest boxes located in the field, and they injected newly laid European starling eggs with corticosterone hormone. What's interesting about this is that corticosterone plays a similar role in birds that stress hormones like adrenaline and norepinephrine do in mammals. Essentially, the scientists were creating artificial stress conditions for the embryo starlings. After treatment, they marked individual hatchlings and tracked them until they fledged at 21 days, and then they took various physical measurements. Initially, Chin's group found no differences in hatching success, brood size, sex ratio, fledging success, body mass, or the size between the birds that had been exposed to the corticosterone and those that hadn't. However, exposure to elevated levels of stress hormone did improve the fledgling's flight performance. Their energy gain after takeoff, an indicator of the bird's takeoff velocity and height gained after takeoff, was actually greater in both male and female fledglings treated with the hormone. Their improved flight performance was associated with physical differences between the treated and untreated birds. Corticosterone-treated birds had larger pectoral flight muscles and a larger wing surface area, which reduced their wing loading during flight. In addition, the physical differences, the property of the actual flight muscles, were also different. There were two enzymes that are involved in metabolic energy production, citrate synthase and creatine phosphokinase, and these had higher activity per unit in the muscle mass in the corticosterone-treated group. The conclusion is that when the maternal bird is stressed, it is likely that the next generation of bird will be able to fly away from that stress faster and farther. So there you have it. Two stories about very different species that suggest stress in mothers is not such a bad thing, although that goodness is not something that I expect my lovely wife, Lisa, to fully support, given her generally high stress levels. My last article has nothing to do with biology at all. In fact, I'm stepping outside of my comfort zone here by addressing it. I've noticed that no one has stepped up to Tony's call for a space scientist to contribute to the sofa yet. Now, I am not a space scientist, but I've always been fascinated by astronomy and astrophysics. In fact, when I was an undergraduate in college, I actually wanted to get a degree in physics, probably based on the huge number of SF books that I actually read involving physics. Unfortunately, none of those novelists ever mentioned that you have to not just be good in math to be a physicist, but you have to be very, very good in math to be a physicist. So unfortunately, I did not fall into that mathematically gifted category. I once had a friend who referred to science as his mistress, and he was actually a physicist. Invoking his disturbing image now, I have to say that not knowing what else to do with my academic career back then, I turned back to my old spurned scientific mistress, biology, and worked on my degree in the life sciences. Biology has been good to me ever since, and she has comforted me and been kind to me, but every once in a while I hear the siren call of astrophysics, and I can't help but ogle at the scientific equivalent of the Dallas Cowboy cheerleader that will always be out of reach. Okay, now that you're stuck with that demented image in your head, let me actually get on with the last science article. Dr. Daniel Rouen of the Observatory of Paris in Mendun, France, reported an amazing find on February 3rd at a symposium in Paris. Apparently, the European Space Agency's Corot satellite has been able to detect the smallest exoplanet yet discovered. An exoplanet is one that is outside of our own solar system. if you don't recognize the term. Exoplanets are detected not with telescopes. They are much too far away to detect optically, although we are getting closer to actually being able to do that. No, they're detected indirectly by examining the wobble. Well, most of them are detected indirectly by examining the wobble their gravity induces in the motion of their parent stars. Since 1999, researchers have discovered more than 40 transiting planets, meaning that they've actually been able to detect them moving across their suns. And most of them are heavier than Jupiter, which is about 318 times more massive than the Earth. And over the past 14 years, astronomers have discovered more than 330 extrasolar planets. That's really a huge number, but they've always suspected lots of planets are out there. It's interesting that every one of those planets up until this point has been a gas giant. It's always been unclear to astronomers whether that's because there are mainly gas giants out there or whether their detection methods were simply not good enough at finding smaller, denser planets. Ruan's group has been studying the planet called Corot XO7b for about a year now. They initially detected XO7b by detecting what they called mini eclipses as the planet crossed in front of its sun, which is 350 light years from Earth. Those eclipses reveal the size of the orbiting body to be between 1.75 and 2 times that of Earth's diameter. After they were sure the planet was actually there, the team followed up with ground-based measurements of the parent star's gravimetric wobble in order to determine the planet's mass. Given the uncertainty of making measurements from 350 light years, for now the team can only say the planet is no heavier than 11 Earths. Before now, the smallest known transiting extrasolar planet was GL436b, a body that was discovered in 2007 and weighs 23 Earth masses. That's about the size of Neptune. This planet is traveling fast, it's close to its sun, and it's hot and kind of dense like Earth. It's been suggested that XO7b may be a planet like Neptune that lost its massive hydrogen gas atmosphere to its sun during too close of an orbit. Why is this important? Well, Dr. Michael Guillon of the Observatory of Geneva, who was a member of this team, says, quote, "This discovery is important because it opens the era of the study of terrestrial exoplanets. For the first time in human history, we can study a solid planet located outside of our solar system. This is a major step toward the detection and study of actual Earth twins orbiting other stars." Unquote. If that is not something that should be reported to science fiction fans, then I don't know what is. Well, that's all from me and my mixed bag this evening. I hope that you've enjoyed it. Thanks for listening. And as always, take care, and I hope that I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella. Ah, P.S. This is an update on my sleep article from last month. Some sofa knots on the forums and in emails to me have raised concerns about strange sleep schedules being harmful, as well as lack of sleep. Well, a paper published in the Proceedings of the Academy of Sciences this week reports that sleeping during the day and staying awake at night can lead to heart and metabolic problems, even after just a few days of out-of-sync schedule. This is a serious problem since lots of people are shift workers and have their schedules backwards in terms of waking and sleeping. Dr. Frank Shear of Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston and his colleagues imposed a 28-hour day on study participants. Now, the normal cycle for most organisms on Earth is 24 hours, so 28 hours is seriously messed up. Five men and five women lived out 28-hour cycles in dimly lit private rooms with no windows and no clue as to what the real time was. Over the course of the 10-day experiment, the total amount of shut-eye did not vary. Participants slept 9 hours and 20 minutes for each 28-hour day, instead of the 8 hours during the 24-hour day. But the times of sleep varied. Each quote-unquote day, volunteers went to bed 4 hours later in the real-world time than they had the previous day. When the volunteers were awake and active in the middle of the night, when their bedtime had shifted by 12 hours, researchers noted a significant spike in blood pressure, a decrease in the appetite-regulating hormone leptin, and higher than normal blood sugar levels. In fact, 3 of the 10 subjects, who were all previously healthy, had blood sugar levels that reached actually pre-diabetic levels. The conclusion was, unfortunately, yes, when you sleep, is just as important as actually how much you sleep. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Have a pleasant evening. Good night.